Arn y Hin Hurin, The Tale of the Children of Hurin, by J.R.R. Tolkien, edited by Christopher Tolkien, and read by Christopher Lee. Chapter 1. The Childhood of Turin. Hador Goldenhead was a lord of the Edain and well beloved by the Eldar. He dwelt, while his days lasted, under the lordship of Fingolfin, who gave to him wide lands in that region of Hithlum which was called Dor Lomin. His daughter, Glorethel, wedded Haldir, son of Halmir, lord of the men of Vrethil. And at the same feast, his son, Galdor the Tall, wedded Hareth, the daughter of Halmir. Galdor and Hareth had two sons, Hurin and Huor. Hurin was by 3 years the elder, but he was shorter in stature than other men of his kin. In this, he took after his mother's people, but in all else, he was like Hador, his grandfather, strong in body and fiery of mood. But the fire in him burned steadily, and he had great endurance of will. Of all men of the north, he knew most of the counsels of the Noldor. Huor, his brother, was tall, the tallest of all the Edain, save his own son, Tuor, only, and a swift runner. But if the race were long and hard, Hurin would be the first home, for he ran as strongly at the end of the course as at the beginning. There was great love between the brothers, and they were seldom apart in their youth. Hurin wedded Morwen, the daughter of Baragund, son of Bregolas of the House of Beor, and she was thus of close kin to Beren One Hand. Morwen was dark-haired and tall, and for the light of her glance and the beauty of her face, men called her Elithwin, the Elven Fair. But she was somewhat stern of mood and proud. The sorrows of the House of Beor saddened her heart, for she came as an exile to Dor Lomin from Dorthonion after the ruin of the Bragolach. Turin was the name of the eldest child of Hurin and Morwen, and he was born in that year in which Beren came to Doriath and found Luthien Tinuviel, Thingol's daughter. Morwen bore a daughter also to Hurin, and she was named Urwen, but she was called Lalaith, which is laughter, by all that knew her in her short life. Huor wedded Rian, the cousin of Morwen. She was the daughter of Belegund, son of Bregolas. By hard fate was she born into such days, for she was gentle of heart and loved neither hunting nor war. Her love was given to trees and to the flowers of the wild, and she was a singer and a maker of songs. 2 months only had she been wedded to Huor, when he went with his brother to the Nirnaeth Arnoediad, and she never saw him again. But now the tale returns to Hurin and Huor in the days of their youth. It is said that for a while the sons of Galdor dwelt in Brethil as foster sons of Haldir their uncle, after the custom of northern men in those days. They often went to battle with the men of Brethil against the Orcs, who now harried the northern borders of their land, for Hurin, though only 17 years of age, was strong, and Huor the younger was already as tall as most full-grown men of that people. On a time, Hurin and Huor went with a company of scouts, but they were ambushed by the Orcs and scattered, and the brothers were pursued to the ford of Brithiach. There they would have been taken or slain, but for the power of Ulmo that was still strong in the waters of Sirion. And it is said that a mist arose from the river and hid them from their enemies, and they escaped over the Brithiach into Dimbar. There they wandered in great hardship among the hills beneath the sheer walls of the Chrysaigrim, until they were bewildered in the deceits of that land and knew not the way to go on or to return. There Thorondor espied them, and he sent two of his eagles to their aid. And the eagles bore them up and brought them beyond the encircling mountains to the secret vale of Tumladen and the hidden city of Gondolin, which no man had yet seen. There Turgon the king received them well when he learned of their kin, for Hador was an elf friend, and Ulmo, moreover, had counseled Turgon to deal kindly with the sons of that house, from whom help should come to him at need. Húrin and Húor dwelt as guests in the king's house for well nigh a year, and it is said that in this time Húrin, whose mind was swift and eager, gained much lore of the elves, and learned also something of the counsels and purposes of the king. For Turgon took great liking for the sons of Galdor, and spoke much with them. And he wished indeed to keep them in Gondolin out of love, and not only for his lore, that no stranger, be he elf or man, who found the way to the secret kingdom, or looked upon the city, should ever depart again, until the king should open the Liga, and the hidden people should come forth. But Húrin and Húor desired to return to their own people, and share in the wars and griefs that now beset them. And Húrin said to Turgon, "Lord, we are but mortal men, and unlike the Eldar. They may endure for long years, awaiting battle with their enemies in some far distant day. But for us, the time is short, and our hope and strength soon wither. Moreover, we did not find the road to Gondolin, and indeed we do not know surely where this city stands, for we were brought in fear and wonder by the high ways of the air, and in mercy our eyes were veiled." Then Turgon granted his prayer, and he said, "By the way that you came, you have leave to return, if Thorondor is willing. I grieve at this parting, yet in a little while, as the Eldar accounted, we may meet again. But Maeglin, the king's sister son, who was mighty in Gondolin, grieved not at all at their going, though he begrudged them the favor of the king, for he had no love for any of the kindred of men. He said to Húrin, 'The king's grace is greater than you know, and some might wonder wherefore a strict law is abated for two knave children of men. It would be safer if they had no choice but to abide here as our servants to their life's end.' 'The king's grace is great indeed,' answered Húrin. 'But if our word is not enough, then we will swear oaths to you.' And the brothers swore never to reveal the counsels of Turgon, and to keep secret all that they had seen in his realm. Then they took their leave, and the eagles coming bore them away by night and set them down in Dor Lomin before the dawn. Their kinsfolk rejoiced to see them, for messengers from Brethil had reported that they were lost. But they would not tell even to their father where they had been, save that they were rescued in the wilderness by the eagles that brought them home. But Galdor said, 'Did you then dwell a year in the wild? Or did the eagles house you in their eyries? But you found food and fine raiment, and return as young princes, not as waifs of the wood.' 'Be content, father,' said Húrin, 'that we have returned, for only under an oath of silence was this permitted. That oath is still on us. Then Galdor questioned them no more, but he and many others guessed at the truth. For both the oath of silence and the eagles pointed to Turgon, men thought. So the days passed, and the shadow of the fear of Morgoth lengthened. But in the 469th year after the return of the Noldor to Middle-earth, there was a stirring of hope among elves and men. For the rumor ran among them of the deeds of Beren and Lúthien, and the putting to shame of Morgoth, even upon his throne in Angband. And some said that Beren and Lúthien yet lived, or had returned from the dead. In that year also, the great councils of Maedhros were almost complete, and with the reviving strength of the Eldar in the Edain, the advance of Morgoth was stayed, and the orcs were driven back from Beleriand. Then some began to speak of victories to come, and of redressing the Battle of the Bragolach, when Maedhros should lead forth the united hosts and drive Morgoth underground and seal the doors of Angband. But the wiser were uneasy still, fearing that Maedhros revealed his growing strength too soon, and that Morgoth would be given time enough to take counsel against him. Ever will some new evil be hatched in Angband, beyond the guess of elves and men, they said. And in the autumn of that year, to point their words, there came an ill wind from the north under leaden skies. The evil breath it was called, for it was pestilent, and many sickened and died in the fall of the year in the northern lands that bordered on the Ungfaugleith. They were, for the most part, the children of the rising youth in the houses of men. In that year, Turin, son of Húrin, was yet only 5 years old, and Úrwen, his sister, was 3, in the beginning of spring. Her hair was like the yellow lilies in the grass as she ran in the fields, and her laughter was like the sound of the merry stream that came singing out of the hills past the walls of her father's house. Nen Lalaith it was named, and after it all the people of the household called the child Lalaith, and their hearts were glad while she was among them. But Turin was loved less than she. He was dark-haired as his mother, and promised to be like her in mood also. For he was not merry, and spoke little, though he learned to speak early, and ever seemed older than his years. Turin was slow to forget injustice or mockery, but the fire of his father was also in him, and he could be sudden and fierce. Yet he was quick to pity, and the hurts or sadness of living things might move him to tears. And he was like his father in this also, for Morwen was stern with others as with herself. He loved his mother, for her speech to him was forthright and plain, but his father he saw little. For Húrin was often long away from home with the host of Fingon that guarded Hithrum's eastern borders. And when he returned, his quick speech, full of strange words and jests and half-meanings, bewildered Turin and made him uneasy. At that time, all the warmth of his heart was for Lalaith, his sister. But he played with her seldom, and liked better to guard her unseen, and to watch her going upon grass or under tree, as she sang such songs as the children of the Edain made long ago, when the tongue of the elves was still fresh upon their lips. Fair as an elf child is Lalaith, said Húrin to Morwen, but briefer, alas. And so fairer may be, or dearer. And Turin, hearing these words, pondered them, but could not understand them. for he had seen no elf children. None of the Eldar at that time dwelt in his father's lands, and once only had he seen them when King Fingon and many of his lords had ridden through Dor Lomin and passed over the bridge of Nen Lalaith, glittering in silver and white. But before the year was out, the truth of his father's words was shown, for the evil breath came to Dor Lomin, and Turin took sick and lay long in a fever and dark dream. And when he was healed, for such was his fate and the strength of life that was in him, he asked for Lalaith. But his nurse answered, "Speak no more of Lalaith, son of Húrin, but of your sister Húrwen you must ask tidings of your mother." And when Morwen came to him, Túrin said to her, "I am no longer sick, and I wish to see Húrwen. But why must I not say Lalaith anymore?" "Because Húrwen is dead, and laughter is stilled in this house," she answered. "But you live, son of Morwen, and so does the enemy who has done this to us." She did not seek to comfort him any more than herself, for she met her grief in silence and coldness of heart. But Húrin mourned openly, and he took up his harp and would make a song of lamentation, but he could not, and he broke his harp. And going out, he lifted up his hand towards the north, crying, "Mara of Middle-earth, would that I might see you face to face, and mar you as my lord Fingolfin did." But Túrin wept bitterly at night alone, though to Morwen he never again spoke the name of his sister. To one friend only he turned at that time, and to him he spoke of his sorrow and the emptiness of the house. This friend was named Sador, a houseman in the service of Húrin. He was lame and of small account. He had been a woodman, and by ill luck or the mishandling of his axe, he had hewn his right foot, and the footless leg had shrunken. And Túrin called him Labadal, which is Hopperfoot, though the name did not displease Sador, for it was given in pity and not in scorn. Sador worked in the outbuildings to make or mend things of little worth that were needed in the house, for he had some skill in the working of wood. And Túrin would fetch him what he lacked to spare his leg, and sometimes he would carry off secretly some tool or piece of timber that he found unwatched, if he thought his friend might use it. Then Sador smiled, but bade him return the gifts to their places. "Give with a free hand, but give only your own," he said. He rewarded as he could the kindness of the child, and carved for him the figures of men and beasts. But Túrin delighted most in Sador's tales, for he had been a young man in the days of the Bragolach, and loved now to dwell upon the short days of his full manhood before his maiming. "That was a great battle, they say, son of Húrin. I was called from my tasks in the wood in the need of that year, but I was not in the Bragolach, or I might have got my hurt with more honor. For we came too late, save to bear back the bier of the old lord Hador, who fell in the guard of King Fingolfin. I went for a soldier after that, and I was in Aethel City on a great fort of the elf kings for many years, or so it seems now, and the dull years since have little to mark them. In Aethel City on I was when the Black King assailed it, and Galdor, your father's father, was the captain there in the king's stead. He was slain in that assault, and I saw your father take up his lordship and his command, though but new come to manhood. There was a fire in him that made the sword hot in his hand," they said. "Behind him we drove the orcs into the sand. and they have not dared to come within sight of the walls since that day. But alas, my love of battle was sated, for I had seen spilled blood and wounds enough. And I got leave to come back to the woods that I yearned for. And there I got my hurt. For a man that flies from his fear may find that he's only taken a short cut to meet it. In this way, Sador would speak to Turin as he grew older, and Turin began to ask many questions that Sador found hard to answer, thinking that others nearer akin should have had the teaching. And one day, Turin said to him, "Was Lalaith indeed like an elf child, as my father said? And what did he mean when he said that she was briefer?" "Very like," said Sador, "for in their first youth the children of men and elves seem close akin. But the children of men grow more swiftly, and their youth passes soon. Such is our fate." Then Turin asked him, "What is fate?"
"As to the fate of men," said Sador, "you must ask those that are wiser than Labadan. But as all can see, we weary soon and die, and by mischance many meet death even sooner. But the elves do not weary, and they do not die, save by great hurt. From wounds and griefs that would slay men, they may be healed. And even when their bodies are marred, they return again, some say. It is not so with us."
"Then Lalaith will not come back?" said Turin. "Where has she gone?"
"She will not come back," said Sador. "But where she has gone, no man knows, or I do not."
"Has it always been so? Or do we suffer some curse of the wicked king, perhaps, like the evil breath?"
"I do not know. A darkness lies behind us, and out of it few tales have come. The fathers of our fathers may have had things to tell, but they did not tell them. Even their names are forgotten. And the mountains stand between us and the life that they came from, flying from no man now knows what."
"Were they afraid?" said Turin.
"It may be," said Sador. "It may be that we fled from the fear of the dark, only to find it here before us, and nowhere else to fly to but the sea."
"We are not afraid any longer," said Turin. "Not all of us. My father is not afraid, and I will not be, or at least, as my mother, I will be afraid, and not show it." It seemed then to Sador that Turin's eyes were not the eyes of a child, and he thought, "Grief is a hone to a hard mind." But aloud he said, "Son of Húrin and Morwen, how it will be with your heart, Labadal cannot guess. But seldom and to few will you show what is in it." Then Turin said, "Perhaps it is better not to tell what you wish if you cannot have it. But I wish, Labadal, that I were one of the Eldar. Then Lalaith might come back, and I should still be here, even if she were long away. I shall go as a soldier with an elf king as soon as I am able, as you did, Labadal."
"You may learn much of them," said Sador, and he sighed. "They are a fair folk and wonderful, and they have a power over the hearts of men. And yet I think sometimes that it might have been better if we had never met them, but had walked in lowlier ways. Already they are ancient in knowledge, and they are proud and enduring. In their light we are dimmed, or we burn with too quick a flame, and the weight of our doom lies the heavier on us."
"But my father loves them," said Turin, "and he's not happy without them. He says that we have learned nearly all that we know from them, and have been made a nobler people. And he says that the men that have lately come over the mountains are hardly better than orcs."
"That is true," answered Sador, "true at least of some of us. But the up-climbing is painful, and from high places it is easy to fall low." At this time, Turin was almost 8 years old, in the month of Gwairon in the Reckoning of Theodine, in the year that cannot be forgotten. Already there were rumors among his elders of a great mustering and gathering of arms, of which Turin heard nothing, though he marked that his father often looked steadfastly at him, as a man might look at something dear that he must part from. Now Húrin, knowing her courage and her guarded tongue, often spoke with Morwen of the designs of the elven kings, and of what might befall if they went well or ill. His heart was high with hope, and he had little fear for the outcome of the battle, but it did not seem to him that any strength in Middle-earth could overthrow the might and splendor of the Eldar. "They have seen the light in the west," he said, "and in the end darkness must flee from their faces." Morwen did not gainsay him, for in Húrin's company the hopeful ever seemed the more likely. But there was knowledge of elven lore in her kindred also, and to herself she said, "And yet did they not leave the light? Are they not now shut out from it? Maybe that the lords of the West have put them out of their thought, and how then can even the elder children overcome one of the powers?" No shadow of such doubt seemed to lie on Húrin Thalion. Yet one morning in the spring of that year he awoke heavy, as after unquiet sleep, and a cloud lay on his brightness that day. And in the evening he said suddenly, "When I am summoned, Morwen Erithwen, I shall leave in your keeping the heir of the House of Hador. The lives of men are short, and in them there are many ill chances, even in time of peace." "That has ever been so," she answered. "But what lies under your words?"
"Prudence, not doubt," said Húrin, yet he looked troubled. "But one who looks forward must see this, that things will not remain as they were. This will be a great throw, and one side must fall lower than it now stands. If it be the elven kings that fall, then it must go evilly with the Edain, and we dwell nearest to the enemy. This land might pass into his dominion. But if things do go ill, I will not say to you, 'Do not be afraid,' for you fear what should be feared, and that only. And fear does not dismay you. But I say, do not wait. I shall return to you as I may, but do not wait. Go south as swiftly as you can. If I live, I shall follow, and I shall find you, though I have to search through all Beleriand."
"Beleriand is wide and houseless for exiles," said Morwen. "Whither should I flee, with few or with many?"
Then Húrin thought for a while in silence. "There is my mother's kin in Brethil," he said. "That is some 30 leagues as the eagle flies."
"If such an evil time should indeed come, what help would there be in men?" said Morwen. "The house of Beor has fallen. If the great house of Hador falls, in what holes shall the little folk of Haleth creep?"
"In such as they can find," said Húrin, "but do not doubt their valor, for they are few and unlearned. Where else is hope?"
"You do not speak of Gondolin," said Morwen.
"No, for that name has never passed my lips," said Húrin. "Yet the word is true that you have heard. I have been there. But I tell you now truly, as I have told no other, and will not, I do not know where it stands."
"But you guess, and guess near, I think," said Morwen.
"It may be so," said Húrin, "but unless Turgon himself released me from my oath, I could not tell that guess even to you, and therefore your search would be vain. But were I to speak, to my shame, you would at best but come at a shut gate, for unless Turgon comes out to war, and of that no word has been heard, and it is not hoped, no one will come in."
"Then if your kin are not hopeful, and your friends deny you, said Morwen. I must take counsel for myself, and to me now comes the thought of Doriath.
Ever your aim is high, said Húrin.
Over high, you would say, said Morwen. But last of all defences will the girdle of Melian be broken, I think, and the house of Beor will not be despised in Doriath. Am I not now kin of the king? For Beren, son of Barahir, was grandson of Gregor, as was my father also.
My heart does not lean to Thingol, said Húrin. No help will come from him to King Fingon. And I know not what shadow falls on my spirit when Doriath is named.
At the name of Brethil, my heart also is darkened, said Morwen.
Then suddenly Húrin laughed, and he said, Here we sit debating things beyond our reach, and shadows that come out of dream. Things will not go so ill. But if they do, then to your courage and counsel all is committed. Do then what your heart bids you, but do it swiftly. And if we gain our ends, then the elven kings are resolved to restore all the fiefs of Beor's house to his heir, and that is you, Morwen, daughter of Baragund. Wide lordships we should then wield, and a high inheritance come to our son. Without the malice in the north, he should come to great wealth and be a king among men.
Húrin Thalion, said Morwen, this I judge truer to say, that you look high, but I fear to fall low.
That at the worst you need not fear, said Húrin. That night Túrin half woke, and it seemed to him that his father and mother stood beside his bed and looked down on him in the light of the candles that they held, but he could not see their faces. On the morning of Túrin's birthday, Húrin gave his son a gift, an elf-wrought knife, and the hilt and the sheath were silver and black. And he said, Heir of the house of Hador, here is a gift for the day, but have a care. It is a bitter blade, and steel serves only those that can wield it. It will cut your hand as willingly as aught else. And setting Túrin on a table, he kissed his son and said, You overtop me already, son of Morwen. Soon you will be as high on your own feet. In that day, many may fear your blade. Then Túrin ran from the room and went away alone, and in his heart was a warmth like the warmth of the sun upon the cold earth that sets growth astir. He repeated to himself his father's words, Heir of the house of Hador. But other words came also to his mind. Give with a free hand, but give of your own. And he went to Sador and cried, Labadal, it is my birthday, the birthday of the heir of the house of Hador, and I have brought you a gift to mark the day. Here is a knife, just such as you need. It will cut anything that you wish, as fine as a hair. Then Sador was troubled, for he knew well that Túrin had himself received the knife that day. But men held it a grievous thing to refuse a free given gift from any hand. He spoke then to him gravely, You come of a generous kin, Túrin, son of Húrin. I have done nothing to equal your gift, and I cannot hope to do better in the days that are left to me. But what I can do, I will. And when Sador drew the knife from the sheath, he said, This is a gift indeed, a blade of elven steel. Long have I missed the feel of it. Húrin soon marked that Túrin did not wear the knife, and he asked him whether his warning had made him fear it. Then Túrin answered, No, but I gave the knife to Sador the woodwright.
Do you then scorn your father's gift, said Morwen?
And again Turin answered, "No, but I love Sador, and I am sorry for him." Then Húrin said, "All three gifts were your own to give, Turin. Love, pity, and the knife the least."
"Yet I doubt if Sador deserves them," said Morwen. "He is self-maimed by his own want of skill, and he is slow with his tasks, for he spends much time on trifles unbidden."
"Give him pity nonetheless," said Húrin. "An honest hand and a true heart may hew amiss, and the harm may be harder to bear than the work of a foe."
"But you must wait now for another blade," said Morwen. "Thus the gift shall be a true gift, and at your own cost."
Nonetheless, Turin marked that Sador was treated more kindly thereafter, and was set now to the making of a great chair for the lord to sit on in his hall. There came a bright morning in the month of Lothron, when Turin was roused by sudden trumpets, and running to the doors, he saw in the court a great press of men on foot and on horse, and all fully armed as for war. There also stood Húrin, and he spoke to the men and gave commands. And Turin learned that they were setting out that day for Barad Aethel. These were Húrin's guards and household men, but all the men of his land that could be spared were summoned. Some had gone already with Húor, his father's brother, and many others would join the lord of Dor Lomin on the road and go behind his banner to the great muster of the king. Then Morwen bade farewell to Húrin without tears, and she said,
"I will guard what you leave in my keeping, both what is and what shall be."
And Húrin answered her, "Farewell, lady of Dor Lomin. We ride now with greater hope than ever we have known before. Let us think that at this midwinter the feast shall be merrier than in all our years yet, with a fearless spring to follow after." Then he lifted Turin to his shoulder, and cried to his men, "Let the heir of the house of Hador see the light of your swords." And the sun glittered on 50 blades as they leaped forth, and the court rang with the battle cry of the Edain of the North, "Lacho Kalad, Drego Morn! Flame light, flee night!" Then at last Húrin sprang into his saddle, and his golden banner was unfurled, and the trumpets sang again in the morning. And thus Húrin Thalion rode away to the Nirnaith Arnoiliad. But Morwen and Turin stood still by the doors, until far away they heard the faint call of a single horn on the wind. Húrin had passed over the shoulder of the hill, beyond which he could see his house no more.
Home is behind the world ahead, and there are many paths to tread through shadow to the edge of night, until the stars are all alight. Mist and shadow, cloud and shade, all shall fade, all shall fade.
We have about 4 minutes left on this intermission, so load up some pipeweed or a cool pint. Prepare for chapter 2 and 3 of Children of Huron. Yagay.net, port 9000. Turn on, tune in.
Chapter 2. The Battle of Unnumbered Tears. Many songs are yet sung, and many tales are yet told by the elves of the Nirnaeth Arnoediad, the Battle of Unnumbered Tears, in which Fingon fell and the flower of the Eldar withered. If all were now retold, a man's life would not suffice for the hearing. Here, then, shall be recounted only those deeds which bear upon the fate of the house of Hador and the children of Húrin steadfast. Having gathered at length all the strength that he could, Maedhros appointed a day, the morning of midsummer. On that day the trumpets of the Eldar greeted the rising of the sun, and in the east was raised the standard of the sons of Feanor,
and in the west, the standard of Fingon, king of the Noldor. Then Fingon looked out from the walls of Aethel Sirion, and his host was arrayed in the valleys and woods upon the east of Ered Wethrin, well hid from the eyes of the enemy. But he knew that it was very great. For there all the Noldor of Hithlum were assembled, and to them were gathered many elves of the Falas and of Nargothrond, and he had great strength of men. On the right were stationed the host of Dor Lomin, and all the valor of Húrin and Húor his brother. And to them had come Haldir of Brethil their kinsman, with many men of the woods. Then Fingon looked east, and his elven sight saw far off a dust and the glint of steel like stars in the mist. And he knew that Maedhros had set forth, and he rejoiced. Then he looked towards Thangorodrim, and there was a dark cloud about it, and a black smoke went up. And he knew that the wrath of Morgoth was kindled, and that their challenge would be accepted. And a shadow of doubt fell upon his heart. But at that moment, a cry went up, passing on the wind from the south, from vale to vale. And elves and men lifted up their voices in wonder and joy. For unsummoned and unlooked for, Turgon had opened the Liga of Gondolin and was come with an army 10,000 strong, with bright mail and long swords and spears like a forest. Then when Fingon heard afar the great trumpet of Turgon, the shadow passed, and his heart was uplifted, and he shouted aloud, Utulien aure! Aya Eldani Ar Atanatarni Utulien Aure. The day has come. Behold, people of the Eldar and fathers of men, the day has come. And all those who heard his great voice echo in the hills answered, crying, Autailome, the night is passing. It was not long before the great battle was joined, for Morgoth knew much of what was done and designed by his foes, and had laid his plans against the hour of their assault. Already a great force out of Angband was drawing near to Hithlum, while another and greater went to meet Maedhros to prevent the union of the powers of the kings. And those that came against Fingon were clad all in dun raiment, and showed no naked steel, and thus were already far over the sands of Unfoglith before their approach became known. And the hearts of the Noldor grew hot, and their captains wished to assail their foes on the plain, but Fingon spoke against this. Beware of the guile of Morgoth, lords, he said. Ever his strength is more than it seems, and his purpose other than he reveals. Do not reveal your own strength, but let the enemy spend his first in assault on the hills. For it was the design of the kings that Maedhros should march openly over the Unfoglith with all his strength of elves and of men and of dwarves. And when he had drawn forth as he hoped the main armies of Morgoth in answer, then Fingon should come on from the west, and so the might of Morgoth should be taken as between hammer and anvil, and be broken to pieces. And the signal for this was to be the firing of a great beacon in Dorthonion. But the captain of Morgoth in the west had been commanded to draw out Fingon from his hills by whatever means he could. He marched on, therefore, until the front of his battle was drawn up before the stream of Sirion, from the walls of the Barad Aethel to the fen of Serech, and the outposts of Fingon could see the eyes of their enemies. But there was no answer to his challenge, and the taunts of his orcs faltered as they looked upon the silent walls and the hidden threat of the hills. Then the captain of Morgoth sent out riders with tokens of parley, and they rode up before the very walls of the outworks of the Barad Aethel. With them they brought Gelmir, son of Gwylin, a lord of Nargothrond, whom they had captured in the Bragolach and had blinded. And their heralds showed him forth, crying, "We have many more such at home, but you must make haste if you would find them. For we shall deal with them all when we return, even so." And they hewed off Gelmir's arms and legs and left him. By ill chance, at that point in the outposts, stood Gwyndor, son of Gwylin, with many folk of Nargothrond. And indeed, he had marched to war with such strength as he could gather, because of his grief for the taking of his brother. Now his wrath was like a flame, and he leapt forth upon horseback, and many riders with him, and they pursued the heralds of Angband, and slew them. And all the folk of Nargothrond followed after, and they drove on deep into the ranks of Angband. And seeing this, the host of the Noldor was set on fire, and Fingon put on his white helm and sounded his trumpets, and all his host leapt forth from the hills in sudden onslaught. The light of the drawing of the swords of the Noldor was like a fire in a field of reeds, and so fell and swift was their onset that almost the designs of Morgoth went astray. Before the decoying army that he had sent west could be strengthened, it was swept away and destroyed. And the banners of Fingon passed over the Anfauglich and were raised before the walls of Angband. Ever in the forefront of that battle went Gwyndor and the folk of Nargothrond, and even now they could not be restrained, and they burst through the outer gates and slew the guards within the very courts of Angband, and Morgoth trembled upon his deep throne, hearing them beat upon his doors. But Gwyndor was trapped there and taken alive, and his folk slain, for Fingon could not come to his aid. By many secret doors in Thangorodrim, Morgoth let forth his main strength that he had held in waiting, and Fingon was beaten back with great loss from the walls of Angband. Then in the plain of the Anfauglich, on the fourth day of the war, there began the Nirnaeth Arnoediad, all the sorrow of which no tale can contain. Of all that befell in the eastward battle, of the routing of Glaurung the dragon by the dwarves of Beligost, of the treachery of the Easterlings, and the overthrow of the host of Maedhros, and the flight of the sons of Feanor, no more is here said. In the west, the host of Fingon retreated over the sands, and there fell Haldir, son of Halmir, and most of the men of Brethil. But on the fifth day, as night fell, and they were still far from Ered Wethrin, the armies of Angband surrounded the army of Fingon, and they fought until day pressed ever closer. In the morning came hope, for the horns of Turgon were heard as he marched up with the main host of Gondolin. For Turgon had been stationed southward, guarding the passes of Sirion, and he had restrained most of his folk from the rash onslaught. Now he hastened to the aid of his brother, and the Noldor of Gondolin were strong, and their ranks shone like a river of steel in the sun, for the sword and harness of the least of the warriors of Turgon was worth more than the ransom of any king among men. Now the phalanx of the guard of the king broke through the ranks of the orcs, and Turgon hewed his way to the side of his brother. And it is said that the meeting of Turgon with Húrin, who stood beside Fingon, was glad in the midst of the battle. For a while then the hosts of Angband were driven back, and Fingon again began his retreat. But having routed Maedhros in the east, Morgoth had now great forces to spare. And before Fingon and Turgon could come to the shelter of the hills, they were assailed by a tide of foes, thrice greater than all the force that was left to them. Gothmog, high captain of Angband, was come, and he drove a dark wedge between the elven hosts, surrounding King Fingon, and thrusting Turgon and Húrin aside towards the fen of Serech. Then he turned upon Fingon. That was a grim meeting. At last Fingon stood alone with his guard dead about him, and he fought with Gothmog until a Balrog came behind him and cast a thong of steel round him. Then Gothmog hewed him with his black axe, and a white flame sprang up from the helm of Fingon as it was cloven. Thus fell the king of the Noldor, and they beat him into the dust with their maces, and his banner, blue and silver, they trod into the mire of his blood. The field was lost, but still Húrin and Húor and the remnant of the house of Hador stood firm with Turgon of Gondolin, and the hosts of Morgoth could not yet win the passes of Sirion. Then Húrin spoke to Turgon, saying, "Go now, lord, while time is, for you are the last of the house of Fingolfin, and in you lives the last hope of the Eldar. While Gondolin stands, Morgoth shall still know fear in his heart. Not long now can Gondolin remain hidden, and being discovered, it must fall," said Turgon. "Yet if it stands only a little while," said Húr, "then out of your house shall come the hope of elves and men. This I say to you, lord, with the eyes of death, though we part here for ever, and I shall not look on your white walls again, from you and from me a new star shall arise. Farewell!" Maeglin, Turgon's sister's son, who stood by, heard these words and did not forget them. Then Turgon took the counsel of Húrin and Húor, and he gave orders that his hosts should begin a retreat into the passes of Sirion, and his captains, Echthelion and Glorfindel, guarded the flanks to right and left, so that none of the enemy should pass them by. For the only road in that region was narrow, and ran near the west bank of the growing stream of Sirion. But the men of Dol Lomin held the rear guard, as Húrin and Húor desired, for they did not wish in their hearts to escape from the Northlands. If they could not win back to their homes, there they would stand to the end. So it was that Turgon fought his way southward, until coming behind the guard of Húrin and Húor, he passed down Sirion and escaped. And he vanished into the mountains and was hidden from the eyes of Morgoth. But the brothers drew the remnant of the mighty men of the house of Hador about them, and foot by foot they withdrew, until they came behind the fen of Serech and had the stream of Rivil before them. There they stood and gave way no more. Then all the hosts of Angband swarmed against them, and they bridged the stream with their dead and encircled the remnant of Hithlum as a gathering tide about a rock. There, as the sun westered and the shadows of the Ered Wethrin grew dark, Húor fell, pierced with a venomed arrow in the eye, and all the valiant men of Hador were slain about him in a heap, and the orcs hewed their heads and piled them as a mound of gold in the sunset. Last of all, Húrin stood alone. Then he cast aside his shield and seized the axe of an orc captain and wielded it two-handed. And it is sung that the axe smoked in the black blood of the troll guard of Gothmog until it withered. And each time that he slew, Húrin cried aloud,
Aure and Tuluva, days shall come again. 70 times he uttered that cry, but they took him at last alive at the command of Morgoth, who thought thus to do him more evil than by death. Therefore the orcs grappled Húrin with their hands, which clung to him still, though he hewed off their arms, and ever their numbers were renewed, till he fell buried beneath them. Then Gothmog bound him and dragged him to Angband with mockery. Thus ended the Nirnaeth Arnoediad, as the sun went down beyond the sea. Night fell in Hithlum, and there came a great storm of wind out of the west. Great was the triumph of Morgoth, though all the purposes of his malice were not yet accomplished. One thought troubled him deeply, and marred his victory with unquiet. Turgon had escaped his net. Of all his foes, the one whom he had most desired to take or destroy. For Turgon of the great house of Fingolfin was now by right king of all the Noldor, and Morgoth feared and hated the house of Fingolfin because they had scorned him in Valinor and had the friendship of Ulmo, his foe, and because of the wounds that Fingolfin gave him in battle. And most of all, Morgoth feared Turgon, for of old in Valinor his eye had lighted on him, and whenever he drew near, a dark shadow had fallen on his spirit, foreboding that in some time that yet lay hidden in doom, from Turgon ruin should come to him. Chapter 3. The Words of Húrin and Morgoth. Now by the command of Morgoth, the orcs with great labor gathered all the bodies of their enemies, and all their harness and weapons, and piled them in a mound in the midst of the plain of Anfauglith. And it was like a great hill that could be seen from afar. And the Eldar named it Hauð en Nirnaeth. Grass came there, and grew again, long and green, upon that hill alone in all the desert. And no servant of Morgoth thereafter trod upon the earth beneath which the swords of the Eldar and the Edain crumbled into rust. The realm of Fingon was no more, and the sons of Feanor wandered as leaves before the wind. To Hithlum none of the men of Hador's house returned, or any tidings of the battle and the fate of their lords. But Morgoth sent thither men who were under his dominion, swarthy Easterlings, and he shut them in that land and forbade them to leave it. This was all that he gave them of the rich rewards that he had promised them for their treachery to Maedhros, to plunder and harass the old and the children and womenfolk of Hador's people. The remnant of the Eldar of Hithlum, all those who did not escape into the wilds and the mountains, he took to the mines of Angband, and they became his thralls. But the orcs went freely to all the north, and pressed ever southward into Beleriand. There Doriath yet remained, and Nargothrond. But Morgoth gave little heed to them, either because he knew little of them, or because their hour was not yet come in the designs of his malice. But his thought ever returned to Turgon. Therefore Húrin was brought before Morgoth, for Morgoth knew by his arts and his spies that Húrin had the friendship of the king, and he sought to daunt him with his eyes. But Húrin could not yet be daunted, and he defied Morgoth. Therefore Morgoth had him chained and set in slow torment. But after a while he came to him and offered him his choice, to go free whither he would, or to receive power and rank as the greatest of Morgoth's captains, if he would but reveal where Turgon had his stronghold, and aught else that he knew of the king's counsels. But Húrin the Steadfast mocked him, saying, "Blind you are, Morgoth Bauglir, and blind shall ever be, seeing only the dark. You know not what rules the hearts of men, and if you knew, you could not give it. But a fool is he who accepts what Morgoth offers. You will take first the price, and then withhold the promise, and I should get only death if I told you what you ask." Then Morgoth laughed, and he said, "Death you may yet crave of me, as a boon." Then he took Húrin to the Howden Nirnaeth, and it was then new built, and the reek of death was upon it. And Morgoth set Húrin upon its top, and bade him look west towards Hithlum, and think of his wife and his son and other kin. "For they dwell now in my realm," said Morgoth, "and they are at my mercy." "You have none," answered Húrin, "but you will not come at Turgon through them, for they do not know his secrets." Then wrath mastered Morgoth, and he said, "Yet I may come at you and all your accursed house, and you shall be broken on my will, though you all were made of steel." And he took up a long sword that lay there, and broke it before the eyes of Húrin, and a splinter wounded his face, but Húrin did not blench. Then Morgoth, stretching out his long arm towards Dol Lomin, cursed Húrin and Morwen and their offspring, saying, "Behold, the shadow of my thought shall lie upon them wherever they go, and my hate shall pursue them to the ends of the world." But Húrin said, "You speak in vain, for you cannot see them, nor govern them from afar. Not while you keep this shape and desire still to be a king visible on earth." And Morgoth turned upon Húrin, and he said, "Fool, little among men, and they are the least of all that speak. Have you seen the Valar, or measured the power of Manwë and Vardar? Do you know the reach of their thought, or do you think perhaps that their thought is upon you, and that they may shield you from afar?"
"I know not," said Húrin, "yet so it might be if they willed, for the Elder King shall not be dethroned while Arda endures."
"You say it," said Morgoth. "I am the Elder King, Melkor, first and mightiest of all of her, who was before the world and made it. The shadow of my purpose lies upon Harda, and all that is in it bends slowly and surely to my will. Upon all whom you love, my thought shall weigh as a cloud of doom, and it shall bring them down into darkness and despair. Wherever they go, evil shall arise. Whenever they speak, Their words shall bring ill counsel. Whatsoever they do shall turn against them. They shall die without hope, cursing both life and death.
But Húrin answered, "Do you forget to whom you speak? Such things you spoke long ago to our fathers, but we escaped from your shadow. And now we have knowledge of you, for we have looked on the faces that have seen the light, and heard the voices that have spoken with Manwë. Before Arda you were, but others also, and you did not make it. Neither are you the most mighty, for you have spent your strength upon yourself, and wasted it in your own emptiness. No more are you now than an escaped thrall of the Valar, and their chain still awaits you. You have learned the lessons of your masters by rote," said Morgoth, "but such childish lore will not help you now they are all fled away. This last, then, I will say to you, thrall Morgoth," said Húrin, "and it comes not from the law of the Eldar, but is put into my heart in this hour. You are not the lord of men, and shall not be, though all Arda and Menel fall in your dominion. Beyond the circles of the world, you shall not pursue those who refuse you. Beyond the circles of the world, I will not pursue them," said Morgoth, "for beyond the circles of the world there is nothing, but within them they shall not escape me until they enter into nothing."
"You lie," said Húrin.
"You shall see, and you shall confess that I do not lie," said Morgoth.
And taking Húrin back to Angband, he set him in a chair of stone upon a high place of Thangorodrim, from which he could see afar the land of Hislum in the west and the lands of Beleriand in the south. There he was bound by the power of Morgoth, and Morgoth, standing beside him, cursed him again and set his power upon him, so that he could not move from that place nor die until Morgoth should release him.
"Sit now there," said Morgoth, "and look out upon the lands, where evil and despair shall come upon those whom you have delivered to me. For you have dared to mock me, and have questioned the power of Melkor, master of the fates of Arda. Therefore, with my eyes you shall see, and with my ears you shall hear, and nothing shall be hidden from you."
Oh. Onda be una dresdama, i salti. thunder, and a tongue to drown the throat of war. When the senses are shaken and the soul is driven to madness, who can stand? When the souls of the oppressed fight in the troubled air that rages, who can stand? When the whirlwind of fury comes from the throne of God and the frowns of his countenance drive the nations together, who can stand? When sin claps his broad wings over the battle and sails rejoicing in a flood of death, when souls are torn to everlasting fire and fiends of hell rejoice upon the slain, oh, who can stand? Oh, who hath caused this? Oh, who can answer at the throne of God? The kings and the nobles of the land have done it. Hear it not, heaven, thy ministers have done it.